We want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives, but can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now welcome your host, Jen Lumenlund.
Welcome to the Your Parenting Mojo podcast. This episode is called Does Your Child Ever Throw Tantrums? And as I wrote that, I was wondering if it's kind of like asking whether you have time to read all of the scientific research published in journals on topics relevant to parenting. The answer to both of those is, of course, right? Actually, if you wanted to read the research and the scientific literature on tantrums, it really wouldn't take you all that long because there isn't that much of it. As far as I could find, the first, last, and only detailed work on the subject was published in 1931, and it's a book that I was actually lucky enough to be able to find in my local campus library. Then the research went quiet for a lot of years, and the pace didn't really pick up again until the 1980s. Even since then, it's been a bit thin on the ground. I wonder whether it's because tantrums are so hard to study in the lab, and because few people have the time, money, and energy to study them in the home. Whatever the reason, it's a bit odd that there's so little information out there on something that's pretty important to a lot of parents. Now, I'm not going to lie, this is a bit of an altruistic episode for me. We've been incredibly lucky with our two-year-old. She's thrown a few moderate tantrums, and we certainly get episodes of whining and crying, but they're almost always explained by tiredness at the end of the day. But I know we're not out of the woods yet, so hopefully this episode will help me to be extra prepared just in case we round a corner one day and she decides that tantrums are the in thing and she's just got to have one. Tantrums are really common in children between the ages of 18 months and 4 years. In fact, they're among the most common childhood behavioral problems reported by parents. While most children do grow out of their tantrums and don't experience lasting ill effects, tantrums in older children can be associated with future antisocial behavior. I was quite curious to find out whether tantrums are a phenomenon limited to Western educated, rich, industrialized, democratic, or weird societies, and also whether they're a development that has arisen since we've started to put children's needs above our own. I was somewhat gratified to find that tantrums do seem to occur in other cultures. Robert and Sarah Levine's recent book, Do Parents Matter?, cites an anthropological study of the Matsigenga tribe, hope I'm saying that correctly, in Peru, where one toddler who's apparently representative of the broader culture was described as threatening to hit his mother, throwing twigs and dirt at her, falling to the ground screaming, and engaging in non-dramatic wailing. Most tantrums are harmless, but an almost 4-year-old accidentally, the emphasis is in the original text, set fire to his house, which burned to the ground along with everything in it. The anthropologist said that tantrums in Matsigenga toddlers seem to be related to the toddler's realization that they can no longer intimidate and manipulate with tears, and that when the tantrum phase is finally over, the children are more self-reliant, calm, and responsible. David Lancey's book, The Anthropology of Childhood, cites several studies of other cultures that mention tantrum-like behavior, although these mostly show a very direct correlation between weaning and tantrums. A woman from the Kung people in the Kalahari Desert, who was interviewed in old age, said, "Some mornings I just stayed around and my tears fell and I cried and refused food. That was because I saw him," meaning her brother, "nursing. I saw with my eyes the milk spilling out and I thought it was mine." Piraha infants in Brazil are treated with great affection and attention, but when newly weaned children throw enormous tantrums, screaming for hours and injuring themselves in the epileptic-like fits, they will be studiously ignored by everyone. Certainly not all tantrums are precipitated by weaning, especially since here in the US we typically wean much earlier than tantrums begin. Another anthropologist studied the people on the Micronesian islands of Palau in the Pacific, and specifically described an incident where a 5-year-old wants his mother to hold him, but she has decided without telling him that today is the first day where he will have to start growing up, and she just ignores his pleas. Again, he throws what we would think of as a very typical tantrum, and indeed other people who witness it see it as nothing remarkable at all. Girls in Palau seem to have an easier transition than boys because they're kept on a tighter leash to begin with. And we would also see 5 to 6-year-olds having tantrums as rather old by American standards. Robert and Sarah Levine note that tantrums are found widely among populations but are not universal, either culturally or individually. So at least tantrums aren't something we've brought on ourselves with our Western ways. The fact that there was a book published in 1939 specifically to describe tantrums implies that this is not a new phenomenon. although the move towards children's dominance in the social hierarchy was well underway by then. The book was written by Florence Goodenow at the University of Minnesota, who somehow convinced mothers of 45 children to keep exhaustive diaries of their children's tantrums, for periods of time varying between 6 and 133 days. Only mothers with at least some college training were allowed to participate because, and I quote, "the making of the records would necessarily require a greater degree of intelligence and education than is possessed by the average parent in the general population," end quote. Goodenough extends her gratitude to these parents in the foreword, but it doesn't seem as though she paid them for the massive amount of time they spent cataloging the frequency and duration of tantrums, as well as behavior during the tantrums and the triggers and what the parents did to preempt or shorten the tantrums. We might question the validity of data reported by parents, even if they are intelligent enough to complete the complicated forms properly, as they may have an incentive to lie about the events in question, especially the triggers and what they did to shorten the tantrums. But if we do accept that the methodology and the small sample size aren't insurmountable obstacles, we can actually learn some valuable things. Firstly, that tantrums seem to peak between the ages of 1 and 2 at a rate of about 1.4 outbursts per hour of observation, declining somewhat linearly to around 0.6 outbursts per hour at the age of 5. There is some tendency for long outbursts to become less frequent as the child gets older, although it's possible that the older child just manifests anger in different ways, like pouting and sulkiness, which parents don't categorize as a tantrum. Children who have older siblings have more frequent outbursts than firstborn children. And Goodenough said this is likely because the younger children in the family are often the victims of attempted domination by their older siblings, and because the younger child can't fight back, they show anger for the purpose of summoning an adult to their assistance. But I wonder whether there's also an element of the younger child learning the behavior from the older children, especially if it tends to get the older child what they want. Rest also seems to have been a factor. There's an uptick in frequency in outbursts after 8 p.m., and also on days after nights when the child didn't sleep well. The immediate causes of tantrums changed over a child's time in the study. Only 2 infants who were less than a year old participated in the study, so we need to particularly take these results with a grain of salt. But objections to routine habits like dressing, bathing, and eating accounted for 25% of outbursts in these groups. A general desire for attention made up 27%, and various minor physical discomforts were responsible for 23% of all cases. In children older than 1, the objections to routine habits were up slightly to 28%, with an additional 27% resulting from conflicts with authority over things not directly concerned with habitual activities, so things like touching something the child isn't supposed to touch. And of course, that was a non-issue in the children under a year. These conflicts with authority become even more important in the second year, switching places with the difficulties over routine habits and followed by social problems with playmates. Problems with self-help increase throughout this time, probably as children try to do more things for themselves and find that, at least initially, taking care of yourself is a skill that needs to be learned and doesn't always come naturally. Goodenough also asked the mothers to record what they did in response to tantrums. Trying to reason with the child or ignoring the tantrum were the most frequent methods used, along with diversion of the child's attention. She then tried to see whether certain methods were more effective at stopping a tantrum. So, for example, were particular methods always the last ones used before a tantrum ended? Whether certain methods were used for children who had few tantrums compared with those who had a lot, and whether certain methods tended to produce after effects like resentment and sulking. I found the results pretty interesting. Bribery, granting the child's desire, removing the source of trouble, diverting attention, providing a substitute activity, ignoring the outburst, and isolation were the most effective at stopping a tantrum quickly. Coaxing, soothing, reasoning, and scolding usually had to be reinforced using another method. On the subject of trying to decrease the overall frequency of tantrums, granting the child's desire, removing the source of trouble, coaxing and soothing are used more often by the parents of children who have frequent outbursts, while diverting the child's attention, reasoning, ignoring the outburst, isolation, and scolding are used more often by parents of children who don't have many tantrums. Resentment and sulkiness are reported much more frequently among children who have a lot of tantrums than who don't have many, no matter what method of attempted control was used. And finally, Goodenough asked parents at the beginning of the study what methods of controlling tantrums they used and correlated that data with the information reported by parents over the course of the study, and found that there were many discrepancies between what parents said they did conceptually at the beginning of the study and what they actually reported doing right after the tantrum. It was pretty interesting to see the list of control methods that Goodenough asked her mothers to choose between as they kept their journals, because none of them really described the way that I've been handling tantrums. For example, this morning, as I laid my 27-month-old on her changing table to change her overnight diaper, she announced that she wanted to make some cone, by which she meant she wanted to make some scones from scratch, which is something we do fairly often, but not at 7:30 a.m. on a school day. I said, "I'm sorry, we can't make scones this morning. We have to go to school." To which she wrinkled up her face, started crying and wailing, "Make some cone!" I said, "You really want to make scones, huh?" And she said, "Yes." And at that very moment, I realized her diaper had overflowed and we needed to get her dressed immediately rather than keeping on her warm pajamas until after breakfast. I said, "Uh-oh, your clothes are wet. We need to get dressed now." She said, "No, keep pajamas on." I said quite firmly, "I'm sorry, your clothes are wet. We have to get you dressed." At which point she acquiesced and we got her dressed while I acknowledged, "I bet you didn't want to take your warm pajamas off on a cold morning. I wouldn't either." By the end of it, she distracted herself, looking at some dry skin on her toe, and then skipped off to have banana bread for breakfast. Now, I don't mean to imply that I hold the key to tantrums, because I don't. I'm just saying that the methods that I use aren't described in Goodenough's list of behaviors that she asked the mothers in her study to categorize their behavior. I guess I would call them acknowledging, empathizing, and firmly stating what needs to be done. I do find that firmly stating what needs to be done to be especially useful. I think Karis must recognize my tone when I say it because it often induces compliance. In some instances, there's not much opportunity for disagreement. I'm not going to let her sit at the breakfast table in clothes covered in pee. She must wipe her dirty hands before she leaves the table so she doesn't get grease and food all over the sofa. She must hold my hand before crossing the street. It's the situations where there is no thing that must happen that I struggle more. When I've read 10 books to her and she wants just tiny one more, and I really don't want to read another one. When she wants to go in her helping tower in the kitchen while I'm cooking dinner so she can empty out the cutlery drawer and I don't want to have to put it all away again. Or she wants to wear 2 sets of pajamas tonight on the hottest night of the year and I'm worried that she won't be able to get to sleep. In those instances, I could put my foot down, but to what end? I don't want her to feel that my will is always the right way, but I do recognize this is a cultural choice. There are plenty of cultures where the parents' will is the right way, and that's just how it is. But in middle-class white American culture, I think, negotiation is generally considered to be a valued ability because it can bring about solutions to problems that come as close as possible to satisfying everyone concerned. But it does seem as though the process of teaching that negotiation is a bit messy, since it tends to happen when 2 people want different things, which invariably leads to an escalation of the toddler's feelings, if not a full-on tantrum. One book that I read called The Social and Emotional Prevention and Intervention Programming for Preschoolers acknowledges that the persuasive approach has a low level of power, which means that the child takes some time to decide that compliance is a worthwhile choice, and this is supported by Goodenough's research showing that parents who try to persuade often end up backing up with another method of control. In one sample conversation the textbook authors cite from a different study, 6 conversational turns are required to get a 5-year-old to clean up a mess, so the teacher has to make 6 requests, 5 of which are rebuffed before the child finally agrees to help. The teacher attempts to persistently persuade by using the same language repeatedly to ask the child for help, and then redirects, explains, and appeals to the child to understand the feelings other children will have when they come into work and find the messy table. The same book cites a series of studies which found that highly inductive strategies coach children to perceive the social consequences of their digressions, so Johnny won't want to play with you again if you keep taking his toys, and to empathize and consider the viewpoints of others. For example, "Look, Toby's crying. He wanted to go down the slide first." The studies found that maternal use of these induction techniques was related to social competence even across time during the preschool period. But it may not be only the induction techniques themselves that are useful. Adults who use these techniques are more likely to model empathetic and pro-social behaviors themselves, rather than other adults who may be more likely to model assertive and maybe even aggressive behaviors. The authors state that it's the use of inductive components along with the persistent persuasion that makes the right emotional experience for the child. If the message about what you want the child to do is clear, and if the child is given the time and the space to perform the behavior, the child is likely to perform socially appropriate behaviors in the moment in question and also internalize them for later repetition. This comes back to the point I was making earlier about how I deal with tantrums. I put my foot down when it's a safety issue, and my toddler usually complies willingly because she hears in my voice it's a non-negotiable item. But most social environments are inherently negotiable, and I think that's partly why we have trouble gaining compliance. Another part is that we expect children to behave in a more mature way than they're capable of. You might want to check out the early episode I did on sharing for more on when children are developmentally capable of understanding other people's point of view. One final point, and it is a long point, that I want to make from Florence Goodenough's study is related to parental consistency. Of course, it's all too easy to say you'll always be consistent, and we know from the reports of Goodenough's mothers before and during her study that what you think you will do in a situation and what you actually end up doing might well be two very different things. When you're in the thick of it with a screaming child, you tend to do what makes the screaming stop. But that lack of consistency sends a message to the child that if you just keep trying, the parent will eventually cave. Goodenough's examples illustrate the point well enough that I'm actually going to read her description of some of the examples of inconsistency and methods of control directly from her book. A child of 19 months refused to take his nap. After kicking and screaming for 5 minutes, he was taken up and the nap was omitted for that day. That night when he was put to bed, the behavior at nap time was repeated. This time he was spanked. A day or so later, he refused to go to sleep without rocking. After 5 minutes of screaming, he was taken up and rocked. The following day, he again demanded rocking when put to bed for his nap. He was spanked. A 4.5-year-old boy was wandering around looking for trouble, according to his mother. It appeared when his mother told him to put his blocks away. He refused, called his mother names, and was sent to bed until he changed his mind. After a few minutes, he was allowed to get up, and his mother picked up most of his blocks for him. It may be noted here that his mother makes a greater use of threats than any other parent in our group. And in many instances, threats appear to be made without any intention of carrying them out. They include a number of threats to tell Santa Claus, to tell Daddy to put his toys in the attic in case he refused to pick them up, to go visiting without him, and the like. The practice is a further manifestation of inconsistency of method since there is so little relationship between promise and fulfillment. In another child of 2.5, a 2-hour outburst was precipitated when the child called his mother bad. The mother insisted upon his apologizing before he could go out to play. In the course of the conflict that followed, the child was scolded, reasoned with, spanked, and isolated in his own room for a considerable period of time. In spite of all the hullabaloo occasioned by the offence on this particular occasion, there are a number of other instances reported in which the child called one or other of the parents bad, with no result other than a mild reproof or soothing. So, Goodenough's research clearly shows that even parents who at the beginning of the study committed to being consistent in the way that they treat their children when tantrums ensue, that these parents are anything but when the tantrums actually happened. The concluding observation of the book is that a subjective judgment of the total home situation secured by a consecutive reading of all records for each child leads to the conclusion that the control of anger in children is best achieved when the child's behavior is viewed with serenity and tolerance, when the standards are set within the child's ability to achieve, and when these standards are adhered to with sufficient consistency to permit the child to learn through uniformity of experience without such mechanical adherence to routine that the child's emotional or physical well-being is sacrificed to the demands of an inflexible schedule. However, when departures from the established schedule are made, they should be determined by a recognition of the needs of the child and not simply by the convenience or mood of the adult in charge. Self-control in the parents is, after all, likely to be the best guarantee of self-control in the child. There's a lot more to say about tantrums, so I decided to split the research into two parts, the remainder of which I'll cover in a future episode, where I'll discuss the more recent research into tantrums and how parents can forestall them to the greatest extent possible, and hopefully get through the rest with a minimum of psychological harm to both themselves and the child. You can find the references for this episode on yourparentingmojo.com. Search for "Does Your Child Ever Throw Tantrums?"
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, and sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift, 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.